Welcome to the daily VFN Radio Highlights, where we're keeping the conversation light at VFNTV.com. Enjoy.
The U.S. Supreme Court Justice that we lost, Antonin Scalia, we're really finding out how significant he's been on the bench for almost over 25 years now, and how important he's been to the First Amendment rights, Second Amendment rights, basically to the church and freedom of faith and just freedom in general and the original interpretation of the Constitution. As a matter of fact, let's just take a look right now, remembering him.
Joining us now with more is Brad Jacob from the Regent University Law School. He studied under Justice Scalia at University of Chicago Law School. Mr. Jacob, what can you tell us about Justice Scalia as a person and a professor?
Well, he was a fine man. He was a very faithful Catholic, a family man, 9 children, and just a very jovial, funny guy. Always liked both in the classroom and on the court. Always liked the joke. I have memories of being in the Supreme Court for oral arguments, and Nino would try to crack up the crowd with some kind of a deadpan one-liner, and Chief Justice Rehnquist was very much a order guy, and he would pound his gavel and glare at him, but they're great, great fun. He was a good man, good man.
How does his influence still affect you today?
Well, probably no one has affected my teaching as a law professor, both in substance and in style, than Antonin Scalia. He was the best teacher I ever had in my life. Not all brilliant people are good teachers, but he was. And so not only do I agree with his approach to the Constitution, but I've so much enjoyed the way he tried to make the classroom a fun experience that I've tried to model that myself.
Now, Justice Scalia is being hailed as a conservative intellectual giant. How did he affect the direction of the Supreme Court and the nation?
You know, whether that's a true characterization depends a lot on what conservative means, because not all of his great opinions were conservative opinions. He was more of a liberal, as we usually use the word, on things like criminal justice, protections for accused, for people in criminal situations. He joined the majority to strike down a law against burning the flag as free speech. What was key was not whether he was conservative or liberal. What was key was his approach, which is to say, let's look at what the Constitution of the United States actually says. Instead of justices making up these 3-part tests and 4-part tests, Roe versus Wade with its infamous trimesters, you can do this in this trimester, none of which is in the Constitution. Scalia significantly moved at the Supreme Court in the direction of saying, our job is to look at the words and the history of this document and do what it says instead of what we want.
How will his absence from the court affect upcoming cases like the Obamacare contraception mandate?
Well, there's no way to know for sure, because none of us knew for sure what was going to happen in any of these cases. But we've now got an 8-justice court, and even numbers are always bad because they leave open the possibility of a tie. So in any case where Scalia would have been the 5th vote, we now presumably have 4-4 ties. When the court splits 4-4, it's as if they never heard the case. The ruling in the lower court, which is typically a court of appeals, is affirmed. But there's no precedent that applies anywhere else in the country. It's just that case ends and the lower ruling stands. So there may be a bunch of those. There may be cases that don't get a definitive resolution. I wouldn't even be surprised if Chief Justice Roberts tries to drop some of the big cases and not decide them at all until he gets back to a full complement of 9 justices.
How could this upcoming battle over Scalia's replacement affect the presidential election?
Well, this has now become a hot potato for everybody. You know, the president has said he's going to put someone on the court. Several key senators and the Republican presidential candidates are all saying that this should wait a year until we have a new president and let that person appoint the next justice. The president can certainly nominate someone, and I expect he will. I believe the Senate has a duty to act, although many people believe the Senate can simply stall for a year. I think they have a constitutional duty to act, but they can always vote down. If the president sends them a nominee and they say, no, we don't want this person, we vote no. And so it's going to be a huge issue for everybody. Both parties are going to be trying to make as much hay out of this as they can and hopefully get a justice that they are comfortable with.
All right. Mr. Jacob, thanks for being with us.
So the big question is, what does this mean? Let's first take a look at what does this mean, because this vacancy on the Supreme Court. Let's take a look now.
U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia has died while on a hunting trip in Texas. The death of the staunchly conservative justice means the balance of power on America's most powerful court will now shift to the Democrats, as President Obama will almost certainly nominate a liberal justice to fill the vacancy. Scalia was one of the most important and influential people in the entire country. Appointed by President Ronald Reagan in 1986, Scalia served on the court for nearly 30 years and helped decide countless cases that have shaped modern American history, including the 2000 Bush v. Gore election recount decision that settled the presidency in George W. Bush's favor, and the 2010 Citizens United case that allowed unlimited election spending by individuals and corporations and the rise of super PACs. Scalia is survived by his wife Maureen and his 9 children. His death gives President Obama the opportunity to seat his 3rd Supreme Court justice after earlier appointing Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan. This is the current makeup of the court. Chief Justice John Roberts was appointed by the Republican President George W. Bush along with the other W. Bush appointee Samuel Alito. The conservative wing also includes Clarence Thomas, appointed by the Republican President George H.W. Bush, and the more moderate Anthony Kennedy, appointed by Ronald Reagan. The 4 liberal justices are Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer, both appointed by Bill Clinton, and Sotomayor and Kagan, seated by Obama. With the Republicans in control of the U.S. Senate, the body of Congress that votes to confirm Supreme Court nominees, the stage is set for a dramatic election year battle to decide Scalia's successor.
This is so important because this is not the Founding Fathers' original intent. The Supreme Court are appointed people, not elected people, but yet it appears we've given them so much power in the Supreme Court. People, it doesn't matter who the president is, it doesn't matter who Congress is, which is a representative from your own community that represents us and represents you. It matters who these justices are. We're going to be talking about that today, but first we want to actually go to Washington and how they're mourning the death of Judge Scalia.
Word of Justice Scalia's death brought many admirers out to the Supreme Court on a cold night to honor his life, his legacy, and his service to the country as the longest-serving member of the court.
It's never too cold to remember a man as warm as Antonin Scalia, and he was. He was a man of deep personal Christian faith. I had many conversations with him over the years, and I was with him in church. The last time I saw him was in church. And I will tell you, he was a unique man. There'll never be another Antonin Scalia. Whether people like him or not, like his decisions here on the court or not, he made a lasting mark on the history of this country.
Some of the most important cases we're facing as a nation are before this court this term. Religious freedom, abortion, immigration. And now, we hate to say it, but I have the court behind me, the Capitol across the street. This is now going to become a political issue. And so we will clearly be praying for our President Obama, for the Senate, and praying that we get a person like Justice Scalia.
While many here in Washington and around the country mourn his passing, Scalia's sudden death crystallizes just what's at stake in the 2016 presidential and Senate races. A presidency lasts 4, possibly 8 years. Supreme Court picks last a lifetime. John Jessup, CBN News, Washington.
I want you to join with me in just asking God, God, have mercy on America, that you, Lord, we just ask you now that you would put in a Supreme Court justice that has your heart for this nation, that has your heart for the people of this nation. We just ask for the right, just person, Lord, in Jesus' name.
You know, when you think about judges, I had the benefit of working with judges when I was in law enforcement. Hmm. And so much evaluation is put on judges, how they handle things, of course, obviously so. But when you think about it, they don't know anything. They don't have any idea what's about to appear before them until it appears before them. It's actually how the officers and the investigators and the witnesses handle that situation. What we do as citizens, we've established a judiciary where we bring all of our evidence, all of our witnesses, all the arresting investigating officers, and we present the evidence before a judge. And quite often we judge our judges based on the outcome when really the outcome was the evidence was bad. It was tainted, you know, or the witnesses was discredited. This guy got a bad witness, or the officers contaminated the scene, or it just wasn't a good arrest, and those type of things. And the judges have to make a decision based on our Constitution, how things are set up. And if we bring good cases to them, and that's what this is the way our country's designed. It's designed where if we can bring a case to the Supreme Court and work its way out of the Supreme Court, then we can change the direction by saying how we're presently doing things is unconstitutional. This is the true constitutional way. They go back and look at the Constitution, and they can just shift. You know, all of a sudden, abortion, we could say in regards to Roe versus Wade in 1973 Supreme Court ruling, they can say, wait a minute, we are called to protect the life, and that child is a citizen in the womb of the mother. And instantly that could be overturned, and it happens all the time. But this is actually Judge Scalia taking a moment and speaking on C-SPAN about judges and how to be careful, because he talks about like garbage in, garbage out. If you bring a good case before us, and as a matter, listen to Judge Scalia yourself.
You really can't judge judges unless you know the materials that they're working with. You can't say, oh, this is a good decision and this was a good court, simply because you like the result. It seems to you that the person who deserved to win won. That's not the business judges are in. We don't sit here to make the law, to decide who ought to win. We decide who wins under the law that the people have adopted. And very often, if you're a good judge, you don't really like the result you're reaching. You would rather that the other side had won. It seems to you a foolish law. But in this job, it's garbage in, garbage out. If it's a foolish law, you are bound by oath to produce a foolish result, because it's not your job to decide what is foolish and what isn't. It's the job of the people across the street. So don't judge judges unless you really take the trouble to read the opinion and see what provisions of law were at issue and what they were trying to reconcile and whether they did an honest job of reconciling them and of interpreting the words of the law in a fair fashion. That's what counts. Unless that's what you want your judges to do, you have a judiciary that's not worth much. You have a judiciary that is just making the law instead of being faithful to what the people have decided. So that's my main advice. Be slow to judge judges unless you know what they're working with.
You're looking at how this, if we see how the nation's set up, what we need to do as a, you know, as a constitutionally sound country, as a people that wants to see the Constitution remain, that wants to see the First Amendment remain, Second Amendment, and
absolutely,
on,
Bill of Rights,
is to say, we got to look at the cases that are going and say, well, this is unconstitutional, and then follow it all the way up. There's some great firms that are out there, like
it's Bennett Law Firm. I'm not
I don't know about Bennett Law Firm, but I know that ACLJ. And Jay Sekulow
and Jordan Sekulow.
Jordan Sekulow. That's what they're doing. They're bringing cases and arguing before the Supreme Court.
And thank God for them, because they've done a phenomenal job over the years.
You'll be hearing, not this segment, but you'll be hearing a segment coming up how, you know, how things are going to be different now based on the loss of this one conservative judge. But you think about what a presidential candidate goes through to get elected. He or she has to come through your town, has to shake your hand, has to speak continually about their policies and procedures. They go through this painstaking electoral process. You know, even if it's messed up somehow, it's still painstaking. They have to go through it.
It's a vetting process that the people have to actually go through, as opposed to a judge. Do you get
let me look at Congress and Senate. They have to go through that same process of getting your support and telling you what they stand for. But a judge, Supreme Court judge, you got 9 Supreme Court justices. Mm-hmm. They get appointed by nominated by a president, and then the Congress would either, you know, support it or don't support it. But it's like, wait a minute, that must not be as relevant as a congressional seat, as a Senate seat, as a presidential seat. And you know what our founding fathers said? That's exactly right. We should have nothing to fear about this. There's equal powers. You have Supreme Court, the judiciary, it's called the judiciary branch. You have the executive branch, and you have the legislative branch, the lawmaking branch. And what Scalia was saying was, we're not the lawmaking branch.
We don't legislate.
If there's a foolish law, if there's a foolish law, we have to answer this particular case based on that foolish law. It's for the legislative branch, your Congress and Senate, to make the laws, and the executive branch to enforce those laws. So you're looking at, why is this third branch of government so, I mean, everybody's just basing everything on these judges. And the sad thing is, the knives that have been driven into the heart of the Constitution has happened on that Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's happened on the Supreme Court. You know, I don't want to name them all, but listen to what David Barton says specifically about what was the founding fathers' original intent. This is when they're writing letters back and forth. You know, these are those papers. They're called the Federalist Papers. That they were writing back and forth and theorizing about how this new experiment, this new thing called America, was going to birth the U.S. Constitution. Let's find out what our founding fathers really thought about the Supreme Court, and why did they say there's nothing to fear at all? Because they don't have the ability to legislate, and they don't have the ability to control finances. Take a look.
The courts and the judiciary, seems like they're into everything today. They have the final word in shaping our national policies on things from health care to marriage, from the right of personal self-protection to public religious expressions, and from criminal justice matters to military policy issues. And we let them do it. We seem to have forgotten a few basic principles that are worth reviewing. For example, let me point you back to this book. This is the Federalist Papers. It's a book considered to be the most authoritative constitutional commentary ever written. In this book, founding fathers who actually wrote the Constitution tell us that, quote, the judiciary is beyond comparison the weakest of the three departments of power. Wait a minute. The judiciary, beyond comparison, is the weakest? Really? In fact, the Constitution made the judiciary so weak that, according to the Federalist Papers, quote, the general liberty of the people can never be endangered from that quarter because, as they point out, the judiciary, quote, has no influence over either the sword or the purse, no direction over either the strength or the wealth of society, and can take no active resolution whatever, and may truly be said to have neither force nor will. In fact, they tell us that, quote, there is not a syllable in the plan, that is the Constitution, which directly empowers the national courts to construe the laws according to the spirit of the Constitution. Wait, the Constitution makes the judiciary the weakest branch, and they have no direction over our public policies, and the Constitution does not authorize them to judge laws according to the spirit of the Constitution? No wonder progressives don't like the Constitution. It restrains them. They don't like being held back from fundamentally transforming the country. It's no wonder that they work so hard to keep the Constitution from being taught in schools. In fact, have you seen what happened in the high school advanced placement textbook? Look at how they handle the Bill of Rights and the Constitution. For example, the Second Amendment here. The people have the right to keep and bear arms in a state militia. That's not what the Second Amendment says. Yeah, but that's what progressives and liberals wish that it said, so they just simply rewrite it to make it the way they want it. Former Supreme Court Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes explained this philosophy in these words. He said, we are under a constitution, but the constitution is what the judges say that it is, or the teachers or textbook writers, whoever. Thomas Jefferson long ago warned us what would happen if we let the Constitution be interpreted solely in the hands of activists who don't like what it says. As he explained to someone back then, he said, quote, you seem to consider the judges as the ultimate arbiters of all constitutional questions. In other words, the belief was that judges were the ones who would get the final say on what was and was not constitutional. But Jefferson continued saying that this is, quote, a very dangerous doctrine indeed. The Constitution has erected no such single tribunal. As he pointed out, quote, the Constitution, on this hypothesis, is a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which they may twist and shape in any form they please. The Constitution, a mere thing of wax in the hands of activist judges. Yep, that's what it's too often become. We've forgotten the warnings of founding fathers such as Constitution signer Rufus King, who declared that, quote, the judges must interpret the laws. They ought not to be legislators. This is why the founders did not give much power to the courts. But we've drifted. We need to go back and study the Constitution. As John Jay, an author of these very Federalist Papers and the original Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, as he reminded us, he said, quote, Every member of the state ought diligently to read and study the Constitution of his country. By knowing their rights, they will sooner perceive when they are violated and be the better prepared to defend and assert them. Every one of us must study the Constitution so we can know what is right, and then we can defend and assert what is right. Now, in this area, we ought to study the Constitution so that we can know the way our judiciary was originally designed to operate. Well, unfortunately, we're clearly not there today. So let's deal with where we are today. We're going to look at an update today on several major issues now in the courts. What the courts rule on these issues will have an impact on all of us for decades to come. In other words, what we're going to cover today is big stuff. One issue that we'll look at is how kids on university campuses, and I mean particularly the conservative or the Christian or the Jewish kids, how they're being attacked in unbelievable ways by liberal and progressive universities and professors. We'll see how cases defending those kids are doing in the courts. We'll also look at court cases that have some great attorneys attempting to level the playing field and take away the institutional advantage that liberals currently have in the area of campaign financing. And we're going to look at cases proceeding through the courts right now that may literally destroy Obamacare or at least radically weaken it through conscience protection provisions. And you may have noticed that right now, our U.S. military soldiers and sailors and airmen who hold and express their personal religious faith, they've become a target under the Obama administration. We'll see what's happening on that front. And finally, we'll look at cases dealing with the recent IRS abuses and the way that the IRS targeted specific citizens and groups merely for the political viewpoint that the IRS suspected that those groups held. By the way, before looking at this IRS issue in the courts, let me just mention a historical perspective on an IRS-related item from the Constitution. It's the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment of the Constitution states the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. Now, many today, including many conservatives, think they know what the Fourth Amendment means, and maybe they do. But you know, the best way to fully understand this or any other part of the Constitution was given long ago by an early U.S. Supreme Court, and they said that in order to understand the intent of any clause in the Constitution, that what we must first do is to determine what they said, quote, was the evil which was intended to be remedied. Now, that's smart. So if you want to know what it means, figure out what the evil was they were trying to fix. So the Fourth Amendment was designed to remedy what problems? Well, the Fourth Amendment behind it, a lot of the problem was the British use of what were called writs of assistance. In the decades leading up to the American Revolution, British officials in America would take a writ of assistance, which is kind of like an open-ended search warrant with nothing specific written on it, it's not filled out. They would walk into private homes and businesses and demand to inspect the colonists' private possessions and belongings. Now, those officials would search and they would dig and search and dig until they found something they could claim was illegal, and then they'd fill out the writ or the search warrant after the fact. Now, this practice gave government officials an unlimited power to search what the Fourth Amendment later identified as citizens' persons, papers, and effects. The founders hated this practice, and so they created the Fourth Amendment to forbid it. As a result, no government official can inspect any citizen's persons, houses, paper, and effects without a search warrant signed by a judge and signed only after someone has attested to a probable knowledge that a specific offense has been committed, and then the warrant has to specifically describe exactly what they're looking for. But today, because we don't know the historical writ of assistance or what it is, think about what happens when an IRS audit. Now, you receive a letter or a phone call from an IRS official demanding to see your persons, houses, papers, and effects. They then begin searching all of your bank statements, all your check stubs, all your receipts, everything else, until they find something wrong, and then they punish you for what they found. Now, they didn't know there was anything wrong when they started, but they searched your persons, houses, papers, and effects without any authorization signed by any judge. You know, if we really understood the writs of assistance in the Fourth Amendment, we would say to the IRS or any other government agency, you want to audit me? Fine. Just get a judge's order specifically detailing the probable cause that makes you think that I'm guilty of something, and then have that warrant specifically list which check stubs, which bank statements, and which receipts you want to see. And if I don't see that judicially signed warrant, you don't see my person's, house's, papers.
This is so important because we need to they quit teaching the law.
Yes.
They don't teach the law. I mean, they don't teach
the Constitution.
Yeah, I know we got to go to a break here, but just understanding that, you know, if you touch somebody without their permission, that's the definition of battery.
Mm.
It's battery, something so small. But yet they don't teach simple things. They teach how to drive a car, maybe. But this, the fact that nobody can search you without having probable cause that you have or are about to commit a crime, that's very important. That's not wrong for you to go, you can't do this. That's actually your expectations.
Absolutely.
Of a citizen of America. And the way things are going now with this big, huge NSA database, they're gathering all this data reportedly on everybody. Now imagine if they just push this liberal court decision, now the Scalia is gone, they're going to dig through all that information, find stuff that people have done, and all of a sudden then submit subpoenas and then prosecute. And it's like, I think it was Stalin that said, you know, show me which man you're talking about and I'll tell you which law he broke.
Wow.
You know, we have to say, dear God, have mercy. Mm. And when we get back from this break, we're going to be talking a little bit more about that, but also about the appeal to heaven. What did George Washington do when these things were going on and why they had the American Revolution? You know, sometimes they say this all the time. As a matter of fact, I think you were even talking about it Sunday. People say, you don't realize what you have till you lose it.
Yes.
Right? Well, if we look back at what we had with the Supreme Court prior to losing Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, so we had some pretty big wins that we'd never had won to that point. As a matter of fact, this is Alan Barton speaking to Kenneth Copeland about David Barton, speaking with Kenneth Copeland about prior to Scalia's passing, what happened only during the time of these particular conservative judges that have been placed on the Supreme Court. Take a look.
I tell you very clearly, I mean, God's right, Isaiah 126, judges affect the righteousness of a land. We've had two new justices put on the U.S. Supreme Court under the current president. Those two justices are what are called strict construction justices. They actually read the Constitution. They have a fear of God. Since those two guys have been put on, America has had the first two pro-life Supreme Court decisions since Roe v. Wade. We have not won a pro-life case at the Supreme Court until these two judges got there. We have won our first Ten Commandments case in 26 years at the U.S. Supreme Court because these guys got there. And these guys actually said, it's okay for people to see things like don't kill and don't steal in public. That's not going to hurt people. I mean, we've won our first faith-based case at the Supreme Court ever. We now have a case where the marriage was challenged, the Defense of Marriage Act, where the federal law says marriage is between a man and a woman for purposes of federal law. That was taken to the court, and the court says, we're not going to overturn that. I mean, we are seeing now a bunch of decisions that have come out right on biblical values because of two new judges who barely give us a 5-4 win. Now, the way the court is split right now, we have four judges that I would say have no fear of God. There's nothing in their behavior that tells me they fear God. We got four judges that clearly fear God or at least understand his standards. And we got one judge in the middle who's not sure what he believes, and sometimes he's with one side of something. So it's really a 4.5 tie that we've got right now. When the next president is sworn in January, of those nine justices on the Supreme Court, six of the nine will be 70 years old or older. It's highly likely the next president's going to shift America's direction for the next 50 years by what goes on in that court. And that's where righteousness is determined.
Yeah, think about that.
I mean, it doesn't matter who the president's going to be 10 years from now or 20 years from now or 30 years from now. We're going to have justices put on there by this next president that are going to shape the nation. They're going to shape our moral policy. They're going to shape our religious liberty policy. They're going to shape the way we're allowed to practice our faith. They're going to shape.
This is so important.
Wow.
This is so important. I mean, who you decide to choose for the next leader, the next president, and Congress and Senate, because they'll have to approve whatever the president nominates,
yeah,
for the next 50 years. I mean, we are where we are now because people just thought of just the presidency and didn't understand all these marshals across the entire land get replaced almost instantly when a new president comes in.
Absolutely.
All these judges across the land gets replaced almost instantly. And think about this. When you study the Old Testament and you look at how the judges were set in places, and you had evil judges and you had good judges, and evil judges just sowed evil into Israel, into the nation. And good judges, God blessed the nation when there was good judges. Remember when Jezebel and Ahab got removed, all of their sons were in these leadership positions. You look at Samuel, when Samuel was the priest, that you know his sons were doing wrong judgments and things that were going on, and that brought, you know, Ichabod, the glory departed. Imagine America's glory departed because we are not thinking holistically of who you put into a particular office. You need to really know their values. It doesn't, I mean, even if you have to say, you know, for the next 4 years, I'm not going to think about my paycheck. I'm going to think about God, that God can provide for me outside this union, outside this whatever government contract that you would get if so-and-so got in. And to say, we just want people who fear God and that will hold things right, because they're going to appoint, nominate people to sit on that bench, possibly, like you're saying, for the next, you know, 50 years. Mm. And then look where we are now. Now imagine 50 liberal years on top of that. And that's why you hear the appeal to heaven going out. That's why you hear Dutch Sheets going from place to place and just crying out for this appeal to heaven. That's why you hear us talking about this appeal to heaven. And for those that are in the Daphne, Alabama area, he's going to be there, I believe, tonight and definitely this weekend. You can find out more. We'll show his website for you.
You've just been listening to the highlights from VFN-TV and the Data Radio program, where we're keeping the conversation light. Listen or watch more programs and check out the VFN Torch at VFNTV.com. Don't forget about our VFN-TV app, where no matter where you are, you can take the light with you and share with your friends. We want to thank our sponsors and partners who make this program possible. Take the time and support our sponsors. You can locate them at VFNTV.com and select sponsors. If you'd like to become a sponsor or a partner, you can do so at VFNTV.com. VFN-TV and the Daily Radio Program, where we're keeping the conversation light.